Welcome back to the program. President Obama is currently on a trip to India, Indonesia, Japan, and South Korea. Arguably, this is more than a simple diplomatic mission or an effort to avoid domestic politics. Rather, it is arguably a journey into what the future of a post-Iraq, post-Afghanistan world might look like as we confront China, face new challenges in a world that might look very different than the Mercator projection map that we grew up with. No one understands this better than our guest this morning, Robert D. Kaplan. He's the senior fellow at the Center for New American Security in Washington. He's the national correspondent for The Atlantic, and he was recently the distinguished visiting professor in national security at the U.S. Naval Academy in Annapolis. He's the author of the previous book, Balkan Ghosts, and it is my honor and pleasure to have him here this morning to talk about his newest work, Monsoon, the Indian Ocean and the Future of American Power. Robert Kaplan, thanks so much for joining us.
It's my pleasure to be here, Jeff.
Great to have you here. One of the things you talk about, and it seems trite on the surface, but yet it's an important point, that in many ways our view of the world is kind of a prisoner of this kind of old Mercator projection map.
That's exactly true. And we all grew up with it. What is the Mercator projection? It's the world laid out in a rectangle, where right in the center is North America and South America. And the Pacific and Indian Oceans are consigned to the edges of the map and therefore to the edges of consciousness. And as a result, we belittle them, when in fact, the 21st century world that we're entering, the center is going to be in the Indian Ocean and the Western Pacific. It's where our Navy and Marine Corps were two ocean navies through the 20th century, the Atlantic and the Pacific, owing to our own Atlantic-Pacific geography. In the 21st century, our Navy and Marine Corps are going to be centered in the Indian Ocean and the Western Pacific, what is generally at the edges of the Mercator map. In other words, countries like India, Indonesia, Vietnam, South Korea, Oman, these countries are going to be as important to us in the 21st century as France and Great Britain were in the 20th.
The idea that the Mediterranean was to the 20th century as the Indian Ocean perhaps will be to the 21st century.
Yes. The Mediterranean and Europe in general, we all know that economic power has been rising in Asia since the late 1970s, in fact, when we had the Pacific Rim countries, the Pacific Tiger economies. But also what's happening precisely because of this tremendous economic growth, which has been sustained for 30 years now in the Pacific, is the transfer of military power from Europe to South Asia to East Asia. So you have the rise of the Indian Navy to be the third largest navy in the world. China, the second largest navy in the world. Japan, with four times as many warships as the British Royal Navy. And then you have the whole global energy interstate system, which brings all the oil and natural gas, the fossil fuels from the Arabian Peninsula and the Iranian Plateau across the Indian Ocean to the burgeoning middle-class fleshpots of Asia in the coastal cities of China, South Korea, and Japan.
One of the points you make is that the wars right now in Iraq and Afghanistan, in many ways, were going to facilitate this rise of the Asian century.
Yes. It's facilitated it because we've been, whatever one may think of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, and they may turn out not too badly in the long run. Nevertheless, they've distracted us from paying attention to the rise of Chinese military power in the region. While we've been pumping billions, even over a trillion into Iraq and Afghanistan, The Chinese Navy has been growing apace, increasing China's been increasing its defense budget by 10% a year for the last 19 years. So we have, the only resource any country has at the end of the day is the attention of its policy, of its top policymakers. And our top policymakers for too long have been focused exclusively on the greater Middle East rather than on East Asia, where economic and military power is rising. And what connects the energy-rich Middle East with East Asia is the Indian Ocean.
And one of the things that is linked so closely together, which you alluded to earlier, is that the increase in Asian prosperity will inevitably lead to greater military growth in the region.
This is what's happened throughout history. We tend to equate, you know, awful weapon systems like ballistic missiles, nuclear weapons, and such with totalitarian states, but such weapon systems are the products of liberalizing economies. It was our economy that allowed for the atomic bomb. It's the rising Chinese and Japanese and South Korean and Indian and even Vietnamese economies that have led to a burgeoning of real post-industrial civilian military high-tech complexes in all these Asian nations. And one of the reasons I throw in Vietnam in this mix is because America may have fought a war with Vietnam, but Vietnam is emerging as one of our closest allies in the Western Pacific, precisely because the Vietnamese need us to hedge against China.
And as this evolves, Asia, these Asian nations will start to develop kind of their own military-industrial complex. What's the consequence of this?
The consequence of this is that the security environment in the Indian Ocean and Western Pacific will be less benign than in the past. Since the end of World War II up until recently, we've had essentially a unipolar security system, whereby the Western Pacific especially was essentially an American lake, an American naval lake. So security was assured through a unipolar system, and that allowed all these countries to just focus exclusively on their economies. China even, because once we balanced with China against the Soviet Union, China didn't need to worry about the Soviet Union, so it could go ahead with its new economic mechanism that has transformed China. So that the consequence is, in the future, you're not going to have this unipolar system. You're going to have all these nations jockeying for position and balancing against each other, which is essentially a less stable system than you had during the Cold War and in the first decade or so of the post-Cold War.
And in looking at this internal infrastructure of the region, the Indian Ocean then becomes kind of the key to how this infrastructure evolves for all of these nations.
Yeah, the Indian Ocean is like the mirror, the great mirror. It allows us to see, you know, reflected back, that the new power relationships of the 21st century, balancing India, China, the United States, all with and against each other, so to speak. It allows us to see, one of the points I make in this book is it's an argument for a maritime view of the world, because in this jet and information age, 90% of all commercial goods still travel by sea. So the reason globalization is allowed to occur is because the sea lines of communication are safe, albeit the nuisance of piracy in the Western Indian Ocean, but they're generally safe, and it's unclear whether they'll be safe in the future.
And as we look at the role of navies in the future, ours as well as all of these others, really commerce becomes its primary goal more than military power.
Yes, yes. This is not a pessimistic argument I'm making in the book at all. In fact, I'm making the argument, told through travel and reporting on the ground, that we're entering a complex new trading system dominated by Arabs, Persians, Chinese, Indians, Indonesians, and others that bears a relation to the trading system that existed in the greater Indian Ocean before the arrival of the Portuguese in 1498, which heralded 500 years of Western dominance.
You talk about this historically as kind of this classical super region that previously had this kind of cultural unity.
Yes, I do. That's exactly right. I discuss the classical super region that existed before the Portuguese, and I'm saying, in effect, that we're going back to this.
What emerges from this in terms of the rivalries that might exist between India and China and between some of the other nations in the region?
China's rise is particularly prevalent at sea with the growth of its navy. And India and China throughout history never had much to do with each other because they were separated by the high wall of the Himalayas. But now you have the shrinkage of distance caused by the advancement of military technology. So that you have Chinese fighter jets at airfields in Tibet whose arc of operations include India. You have Indian warships in the South China Sea and Chinese warships in the Indian Ocean. The result is that you have China and India have overlapping areas of military and economic influence. This will bring them into a rivalry that never existed before between these two countries.
And to the extent that that rivalry has not existed before, that there isn't a historical basis for it, it is therefore arguable that it is less prone to conflict necessarily.
That's absolutely correct. You're not dealing with an ancient hatred. You're not dealing with this hot-blooded antagonism that separates India from Pakistan. When Indians look at Pakistan, they see the modern summation of all the Muslim invasions into the Indian subcontinent going back into history. That is not the case between India and China. India and China also have a very complementary trading relationship, so that too will further stabilize the situation.
You talk about China moving to the south and India moving to the east and west in terms of its sphere of influence. Talk about that.
Yes. Think of China, moving vertically south towards the Indian Ocean and India moving horizontally east and west along the Indian Ocean. China's moving south in the sense that China doesn't have a littoral on the Indian Ocean, but it is building rather significant port projects in Gwadar in Pakistan, in Chittagong in Bangladesh, in Kyuk Fru in Burma, and in Hambantota on the southern tip of Sri Lanka. China is also providing military and economic aid to all these Indian Ocean states. So what China is not developing naval bases of its own, but what it is developing is a sort of the 21st century, 19th century British coaling stations along the Indian Ocean route, through which super tankers will have to come, bringing oil and natural gas from China, from the Middle East to China. India feels surrounded by this development. India is, when Indians look back at their history, they see a figure, British Viceroy of India, Lord George Nathaniel Curzon, who is viceroy from 1899 to 1905. And Curzon's view of India was greater India that included Pakistan, Burma, Bangladesh, and which required shadow zones of influence in Iran, in the Persian Gulf, in Central Asia, and in Southeast Asia. That is how Indian policymakers see things today. Even though India is a democracy, it has close links with the Burmese military regime. Why does it do that? Because India is competing for influence with China in Burma. Burma is very rich in natural gas, timber, hydropower, strategic minerals and metals, all of which China requires. So China is building rail links and road lines to Burma. India can't sit by and watch this happen. So India is developing its own links with the Burmese military, and it is, it's developing a port at Sitwe off the natural gas fields in the Bay of Bengal, and India would like to have a pipeline from Burma west into India bringing energy.
Is it safe to say that so much of what we have been talking about really does revolve around energy, around hydrocarbons being the basis of China and India's foreign policy?
Yes, and strategic minerals and metals as well. More China's foreign policy. China is not a missionary power. It doesn't seek to promote an idea or an ideology. It's not like the U.S. promoting democracy around the world or the old Soviet Union promoting communism. China's foreign policy is driven by the need for hydrocarbons, metals, and minerals, all of which China requires to raise the living standard of hundreds of millions of Chinese, a fifth of humanity, and bringing them into the middle class.
Is there a Chinese grand strategy?
I'm not sure. I'm not sure the Chinese themselves know what their grand strategy is. The reason I say that is the Chinese argue themselves about what they should do with the port at Gwadar in Pakistan once they build it. Is Pakistan stable enough to build roads and pipelines connecting Gwadar with Western China? China is not monolithic. It's not a totalitarian state. It's authoritarian, but there are a lot of intellectual battles fought within China, among Chinese think tanks, etc. So I'm not sure that there's a Chinese grand strategy as yet.
Given this broader nexus between military and economic power that we've been talking about, where does the U.S. in general, the U.S. Navy in particular, fit into this equation?
The United States and the United States Navy in particular will remain the indispensable balancing power in Asia, because we are the only Asian power that does not have territorial pretensions on the Asian mainland. So that the Indians, the Japanese, the South Koreas, South Korea, Indonesia, all the countries which President Obama is visiting on this trip, require us as a way to hedge against the growth of China, as a way to help manage China's rise.
There is this sense, as you write about it, that these nations, particularly the U.S., India, and China, are all very careful or will continue to be very careful not to provoke each other.
Yes, that's the sense that I get. China doesn't want full-fledged naval bases on the Indian Ocean because that would be too provocative to India. The United States probably doesn't want a naval base again in Vietnam because that would be too provocative to China. These nations are very careful, because the last thing we want to do is to give some ammunition for some nationalists and militarists in the Chinese power structure, especially.
You make this analogy to the Caribbean and the growth of the U.S. and the West. Talk about that analogy.
Yes. A body of water that's emerging as extremely important is the South China Sea, which is sort of the eastern edge of the greater Indian Ocean system. The South China Sea is home to large deposits of oil and natural gas. It's where the bulk of commercial traffic and energy headed for South Korea, coastal China, and Japan goes through. Like the Caribbean, it's a marginal sea, which means in geographical terms that it is partly enclosed, partly open to the ocean, much like the Caribbean is. The United States, let me go back a minute. There's a lot of conflicting claims in the South China Sea. The Malaysians, the Filipinos, the Vietnamese all have claims over different parts of the South China Sea that are in conflict with each other. But China, not only has claims that are in conflict with these other countries, China claims the South China Sea as its own, as a core national interest. The Chinese approach to the South China Sea is very much like the American approach to the Caribbean in the decades leading up to the building of the Panama Canal, whereby the Americans understood that the Caribbean was in an international waterway, but at the same time, they sought to dominate it. China feels similarly to the South China Sea. It realizes it is an international waterway, but at the same time, it seeks to dominate it.
Coming back to the realities that we face today, talk a little bit about India's relationship with Afghanistan and also how Iran is playing a role in what's emerging in this part of the world.
Yes. To Americans, Afghanistan may be part of remote Central Asia. To Indians, it's part of the very close-by subcontinent. From late antiquity all the way up through the early modern era, you had one polity after another that had included eastern Afghanistan, what is today Pakistan, and all of northern India in the same country, the same polity. So that Afghanistan is part of India's sphere of influence. India requires a relatively benign, non-radical Pakistan that is not, Afghanistan rather, that is not a mere surrogate of Pakistan. Pakistan requires the opposite. India, in fact, is even helping Afghanistan build roads into Iran so that Afghanistan will lean closer to Iran rather than to Pakistan. India is using Iran as a hedge against Pakistani influence in Afghanistan. The Indians are so concerned about an Islamic fundamentalist takeover in Afghanistan that they want to fight in Afghanistan down to the last American troop.
Talk a little bit finally about the monsoons, the reality of them in this part of the world, and the broader metaphor that you talk about.
Yes. The Indian Ocean is the only great ocean that has the monsoonal system. A monsoon is not simply a storm. It doesn't connotate a disaster. It connotates instead a weather pattern that brings prosperity, growth, unity. It is necessary for life. And what's different about the monsoon than other winds is that it's entirely predictable. It flows for 6 months a year in one direction, northeast, southwest, then reverses itself like clockwork and flows for 6 months a year in the other direction. Because the monsoonal winds are generally predictable, it allows sailors to calculate distances, knowing when they'll arrive, when they need to leave, so that the Indian Ocean did not require the age of steamships to unite it.
Robert Kaplan, the book is Monsoon, The Indian Ocean and the Future of American Power. Robert, I thank you so much for spending time with us.
My pleasure, Jeff.